Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Wisconsin Lakes Partnership is holding their 34th annual Lakes Convention on April 10, and it runs through April 12 at the Convention Center in Green Bay. The convention theme is Partnering for Lakes, and it's going to focus on how we can continue to work together to protect our state waters. This is a group of lakefront property owners, farmers, swimmers, scientists, builders, business owners, anglers, realtors, lake groups, government officials, boaters, foresters, teachers are the Wisconsin Lakes Partnership. Two of the people who are involved in this will be with us this hour to talk about the state of our lakes. Darby Nelson is an author and a scientist, a teacher, and a former lawmaker from Minnesota. He is a lake advocate and has summarized his career-long affair with lakes in his 2011 book, which has been highly acclaimed for love of lakes. It's being compared to Aldo Leopold's Sand County Almanac for its personal approach to explaining the natural world. Darby is one of the keynote speakers at the 2012 Wisconsin Lakes Partnership Convention. Darby, thank you so much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Also, Eric Olson is joining us, director of the UW Extension Lakes Program based in Stevens Point. He works with the Wisconsin DNR and the nonprofit group Wisconsin Lakes to educate the public about effective lake protection. And Eric, thank you very, very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having us on.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Let's start with sort of a general picture of the health of our lakes. The book summary says, we say we love our lakes, yet we not only allow but participate in their deterioration. Despite our professed love nationwide, more than 43% of surveyed lakes and 80% of urban lakes do not meet water quality standards. Darby, what are those standards? Why are we falling short?
Well, we're falling short for a number of reasons. The EPA study not only identified what that 43% of lakes nationally are not meeting water quality standards, but the 80% of the urban lakes are also not meeting water quality standards. But in addition to laying out that sort of broad picture, what EPA did was try to identify exactly what you've asked. You know, what sort of factors are responsible? What's causing those lakes to not meet standards? And they have actually a fairly lengthy list of those features. But the top, I can tell you what the top three are. First off, and this is EPA's determination: poor habitat condition along lake shores, lack of physical habitat complexity, and clearly high levels of phosphorus and nitrogen, particularly phosphorus. And the list goes on, but those were the top three that seemed most often to be causing the inability of the so many lakes of ours to not meet this.
And what causes high levels of phosphorus and nitrogen?
Well, let me just focus on phosphorus, because that's more
sure.
Typically the problem. What we're doing is we're allowing phosphorus to enter lakes in ways that it historically has not been the case. You know, you talk to folks about who've had a little bit older than a couple of decades, but go back in time, and they'll tell you about how they, as kids, you know, the water on their lake or the lake that their uncle owned or whatever was just so clear.
Mm-hmm.
And now those same people are saying, my gosh, I get to that lake and it's not like the same lake I knew. And that one of the differences, and there's certainly a number of changes, but we've got a lot of development along lake shores that we really didn't have, and a number of activities that are happening along lake shores that I think people inadvertently don't, it's not that they do things maliciously. It's that people, I think, to some degrees, really don't understand the kinds of things that contribute, for example, to phosphorus going into bodies of water. And there's some great examples of sort of what simple things that make an impact. In the fall, in Minnesota and Wisconsin and a lot of other places, leaves fall to the ground and they land on roadways and they end up in storm sewer grates and so forth. And it turns out that a 5 leaf bags worth of leaves contains about a pound of phosphorus.
Oh, my.
And if that 1 pound of phosphorus can deliver between 500 and 1,000 pounds of algae and aquatic plant material. So something as simple as that is partly responsible. We've also got a number of lakes facilities, buildings and cabins and houses on lakes that sadly for lake health have beautifully, you know, fertilized lawns, mowed down right to the edge of the water. And the data on that is pretty clear that if you compare phosphorus running off into the lake from one of those places where the lawn goes right down to the water's edge, that setting will produce 7 to 9 times more phosphorus than would be true if there was a buffer between the edge of the water and actually the lawn material. So those are a couple of examples of where we're just really not sort of recognizing that phosphorus is a big player and we need to be a little bit more careful about it. And then there's some really exciting things happening, I think, both in Wisconsin and Minnesota, where people are recognizing that and lake associations are getting involved, and they're saying, mm-hmm. Hey, let's do something about this. And things like this prevention of phosphorus or reduction of phosphorus movement in is great. I'll tell you, there's a really neat activity that happened in the metro area of Minneapolis this last fall when a Rotary Club said, we've had it. We're tired of looking at lakes that are less than what they should be in terms of water quality, and they engaged in a community cleanup effort simply to get leaves off the storm sewer grates, I guess you could say. And that group of Rotarians gathered together Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and adults and you name it, and they had a whole body of people that pulled in 300 leaf bags that are now keeping, and the leaves then went to a compost pile where they ought to have been rather than being left along the edge of something that could get into a lake. And that 300 pounds, if you do all of the arithmetic, suggests somewhere in the neighborhood of 45,000 pounds worth of algae and
wow.
plant mass that was kept from going into the waterways.
Wow.
And the leader of that organization, the person who's going to become the regional director, was so excited about the success they had, he is vowing to start in western Wisconsin and go through the Minnesota metropolitan area to really make even a bigger difference next fall. So it's stuff like that that's really encouraging.
And you come in this regard, Eric, because part of what you do is to let people know. I mean, it takes some education efforts, big education efforts, so that people will know the consequences of their actions.
Certainly, and it's an ongoing challenge with regard to lakes because there's always turnover in the properties. There's always new people coming
yes.
to lakes who maybe didn't grow up on that lake, and they're trying to understand, you know, why is the lake changing the way that it is? And they also, we increasingly hear people just asking, well, what can I do to help protect this lake? And there's, as Darby was hinting, there's really a litany of different activities people can engage in. But they never want to do the wrong thing. You know, it's sort of like a doctor, do no harm. So we provide a lot of education through UW Extension to help people do the right thing, mm-hmm. to make sure that they're not harming the lake, but also improving the lake.
Yes.
So the convention every year is really one sort of high point of that because we bring people together from across the state to share some of the latest ideas and thoughts. But we have ongoing programs as well. We obviously maintain a web page where people can easily access information. We have a newsletter that goes out to over 20,000 households in Wisconsin every quarter, a free newsletter, just kind of giving them more updates and ideas about what they can do to protect lakes. And then we also do publications, different books that we produce through UW Extension, just summarizing, I guess, different ways that people can engage in the lake protection and restoration process.
Well, it's such an important part of who we are. We're a beautiful state, partially because we have beautiful lakes, and we darn well better make sure we continue to have beautiful lakes. It's where we go to get nourished again. It's where people make a living, some of them do. It's such an important part of our landscape.
Sure, and I think people both Darby in Minnesota and anybody in Wisconsin knows that it's these lakes that function really as a magnet to draw people from throughout the upper Midwest, from Chicago, from Iowa, from points even further away. There's a lot of lakes in Wisconsin that draw seasonal visitors from as far as California and Florida, people who just want to relax and be by a nice, calm, quiet lake. And we don't think about it, but most of those people, they have to work, you know, their whole year. It's a retirement goal for them, but they're basically the thing that's motivating them in part to work so hard, to put in overtime, and then to allocate their vacation time to come to Wisconsin or Minnesota is just that restorative power of those lakes, to be able to spend time out there reflecting on themselves, maybe swimming in the lake. Fishing certainly is one of the more popular things to do, and a lot of people like to just bring the kids to the lake and let them explore and jump in the lake and find themselves experiencing, I guess, the magic of clean waters in Wisconsin.
Tell me about your journeys on the lakes that are documented in your book, Darby.
We've had lots of journeys.
Yes.
What got to me and to what stimulated me to write the book was to look at this paradox, you know, that we love our lakes, and I believe people when they say that really do indeed mean that. They're not just saying it. But I juxtapose that to okay, we love them, but we not only allow, but we participate in their deterioration. So what? And that just boggled my mind. I couldn't make sense out of it. There was no logical explanation, and so that triggered this lake journey, as I call it, that ultimately ended up in the book. What I learned, or we ended up visiting, my wife was often with me, but we visited about 46 different lakes, many from Minnesota, but also broadly Wisconsin and northern Illinois and a number of other, some Canadian lakes, as well as really ending up in the East Coast, Vermont, and certainly Walden Pond, where Thoreau was, mm-hmm. had his cabin. And what we learned, I learned a number of things, in fact. And I, again, the goal was to try to make sense out of this paradox, to try to better understand just what explained this conundrum. And I came up with actually about three different features that I think are contributing. And I do think at the by the end of the book that I really did have a handle on sort of what. At least a partial explanation for the paradox. The first thing, and I mean, I'm an academic, and I began thinking, well, maybe it's as simple as people lack understanding of basic lake ecology. We'll do something at their lake shore and not really realize that it has negative effects. And in the book, I get into that, and I think there's pretty good evidence that that's true. And I pick a particular aquatic plant, Cara, as an example of this is a plant that forms a basically a meadow on the bottom of a lake, and you can think of it really as sort of like a thin blanket with a lot of structure, almost like a miniature little jungle that provides incredibly important habitat for minnows, for aquatic insects, for microcrustaceans, for walleye and northern sac fry that are going to start life as tiny little creatures, very vulnerable. And what I discovered was that they're one of the saddest slides that I show when I give a talk is a picture of a huge pile of cara that has been brought up on the shore, raked up from the water, where the landowner, the property owner, apparently from edge of property to edge of property, just cleared out all of the cara. And the consequences of that are really significant, and it's not just the protection of walleye fry and so forth, but it's what that blanket does is it holds the sediments in place. A typical lake is going to have some wave action, and if the sediments are bare, that wave action can stir the sediments, the particles get turned up into the water column, and you have a less clear lake than you started with. But even more important than that, excuse me, is the fact that in most lakes, most of the phosphorus is in the bottom sediments. And what the cara does, what that blanket does, is hold the phosphorus in the sediments where it doesn't cause us problems. But if you remove the cara, you remove the blanket, now we get the big wave action, and my word, we're not only releasing sediment materials into the water column, we're releasing phosphorus, which is going to do what? It's going to stimulate blue-green algae and other kinds of growth that really, really change the clarity of the water. And I look at that picture and I think, that person clearly didn't do that clearing purposely. I suspect that person had no idea what the cara, the benefits that cara is producing. No owner of property is going to want to swim in cara. I mean, that's pretty clear, and so it's understandable that people would rake a zone, you know, maybe in the middle of their lot, for swimming and boating purposes, where you can get in and out for recreation. But then, could we not just leave the other parts of the property alone? Let the cara do its thing, and we get a twofer. We get to swim and we get to boat, but we also then get the benefit of protection of the lake water clarity by letting cara do its thing. Mm.
So how do you let people know about that, Eric, so they don't do that?
Well, it's an ongoing challenge. We've done research with people from UW-Madison and elsewhere to try to investigate sort of what Darby is getting at. What is it that initially motivates people to take certain actions around their lake? Some of them, as he just described, aren't healthy for the lake. And what motivates them to do things that are good for the lake? And what we find is that people, believe it or not, they'll listen to their neighbors, they'll listen to their local lake group, but oftentimes they're not tuned into a statewide story or a statewide media approach, that it's hard for us from UW Extension to reach out to an individual landowner and be effective. What we instead try to do, actually, is encourage local lake associations, of which there are hundreds around Wisconsin. There's lake associations and lake districts, to allow them, basically, to take the lead in working with landowners to both educate them ahead of time. A lot of times, a local lake association will put together a welcome packet. So when there's a new real estate property owner in town, someone just bought the cabin, they can get a packet that informs them of some basics about taking care of lake properties and what they need to do. It also gives them a personal connection if that person actually meets the new resident and talks to them and lets them know that there's a local lake association that they can connect with and ask questions to. So that's critically important, I think, is doing that. And the other part is just showing, I guess, what good practices look like, demonstrating on the landscape what can be done, and or better yet, what should be done. And what's interesting, we've seen, I think, in the last 10, 20 years, really a sea change, for example, in the way that the Department of Natural Resources treats some of its own properties, and more counties and other local governments are starting to get on with this, that they realize that it's hard to tell people that they should be doing one thing with their land while maybe the DNR or a county isn't doing the same thing with their land. And so boat landings, parks, our state forests, these are all opportunities to demonstrate what good shoreline restoration and protection practices look like, because we know they get millions of visitors across, for example, the park system. So the DNR and other people have really focused on some of these areas, high visitation areas, to show that you can not only get that twofer that Darby was mentioning, you can enjoy the lake, you can still fish it, you can put your boat in, but we can also do things like slow down the runoff that's going into the lake, or restore a shoreline buffer to put some native plants in place and also slow down even more runoff, or simply allow some of those aquatic plants to stay where they are and to actually foster them. So oftentimes when you visit public property now, public lands, you'll see evidence of active restoration projects. So I believe it's going to take all these different approaches. There's
Yes.
no single strategy that's going to do it.
Welcome phone calls for both our guests, and here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. All of these issues will be discussed in great depth at the 34th Annual Wisconsin Lakes Partnership Convention. The question is, how do we keep our lakes healthy? We're speaking to you from Wisconsin, so we're of primary concern of in the state of Wisconsin, but also Minnesota and really all lakes in the country. Darby Nelson, an author, scientist, teacher, former legislator from Minnesota, author of a book that was published in 2011, For Love of Lakes, which is being compared to the Sand County Almanac for its personal approach to explaining the natural world. He will be one of the keynote speakers at the aforementioned conference. Eric Olson, director of UW Extension Lakes Program based in Stevens Point. His office works with the Wisconsin DNR and Wisconsin Lakes to educate the public about effective lake protection. To your phone calls in a moment. We have a full line of phones all lit up, so you can also use our email address, and that's talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank yous are very much in order. We just finished our spring membership drive, and we had great response. 7,000 listeners pledged, 1,500 are new members. And you donated $780,000 to fund Wisconsin Public Radio and the programs that you love. And you also gave, I think this is wonderful, more than 46,000 meals to area food banks. Thank you very, very much. Let's go to phone calls. Alan in Oshkosh. Hi, Alan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
To get back just to the basic point, I think, honestly, the easiest thing to do is just stop mowing lawns. If you didn't have the lawn clippings going and the leaves, if you have a long grass, the leaves don't get blown around, so they would stay where they are, and they're supposed to rot where they stand anyway. Plus just the whole environmental aspect of not burning fuel in every lawnmower across the country. And I'll take your response off the air.
Thanks for the call. Darby?
I totally agree. I think folks... Often folks really are looking for that lawn appearance. It's like, unlike years past, where a cabin is a pretty simple place and there wasn't a lot of lawn work at all. But a fair number of people these days really going to kind of bring the suburban house to the lake, and that means to make it look like back home. But the caller is absolutely right. I mean, that's one way of doing it. If we could have just natural vegetation, wow, that would make huge, huge difference.
What's the problem with golf courses on lakes?
Well, golf courses, it depends on the location of the golf course relative to the lake. If it's literally at the edge, I mean, golf courses are known for being quite fertilizer requiring.
Mm-hmm.
And the extent to, I mean, it depends on the terrain, it depends on the lay of the land as to whether there's a slope that goes that right off the mowed grass to a body of water. That's going to have greater consequences than if there's some barrier in between. What I'm aware of, however, is that there's a growing sensitivity of golf course folks. And there are a number of things that can be done, certainly in terms of just fairly minor changes of topography that maybe the incorporation of holding ponds where some materials would get caught there rather than being allowed to percolate into the lake itself.
We go next to Cody in Oshkosh. Hi, Cody.
Hi. I was wondering how cities are affected by this. Here in Oshkosh, we're building a bike path for a long distance on both sides of the river eventually. A lot of the places, they're pounding steel straight down. Some places, they are using riprap. What's your opinion on what cities should use for borders?
Eric, you want to take that?
Cities are obviously given a little bit more latitude than what we find in the countryside. So when you go to downtown Milwaukee, for example, you're going to find the Riverwalk area. And this is obviously a very modified riverfront and lakefront environment, and it has been for well over 100 years. We certainly encourage people to try to get some restoration in those places. Most importantly, in the urban context, just trying to deal with the overall runoff picture, and that usually extends quite a ways beyond the shoreline itself. Whenever you have a municipal storm sewer system that gathers all the stuff that comes off the streets throughout the city and then typically delivers it untreated right into a riverway or a lake, that's where we have a lot of issues, because what that means is that basically everyone in that city is a lakefront property owner. Whatever happens on their yard, if it drains off into that storm sewer and then gets delivered into Lake Winnebago or gets delivered into the Fox River or into Lake Michigan, it's really going unchecked right into the lake environment. So can a city, while it's doing this recreational development, which is great too because people need to be able to connect and relate to those lakes, while it's doing those projects, can it also put in some infiltration areas, some storm basins that basically stop the water and allow it to infiltrate into the groundwater? Because what the soil does is actually filters out a tremendous amount of that phosphorus, for example, and a lot of the plants then in those infiltration areas will also use those nutrients, and they'll also pull out some of that water. So it's hard because people love to – it's a triumph, really, that people actually want to go down to the Wisconsin River, that people want to check out some of these water bodies that really, before the Clean Water Act and before a lot of things we did 40 years ago, people, they thought they stunk. They didn't want to go down there and check these places out. But now they're drawn to them, and cities are trying to respond. It's a delicate balance, I think. But as long as they can focus on the stormwater thing, they'll be in better shape.
What about all of these services, Darby, that keep your lawns free of any kind of weeds? So many people in cities, and I would imagine around lakes, too, use these. Have they become a little bit safer or not?
Safer in what sense?
I don't know, in terms of using chemicals that aren't as dangerous.
Well, yeah. Now, I can tell you about Minnesota, but in terms of lawn chemicals, the one that is principally of concern is, of course, fertilizer that has a lot of phosphorus. And in Minnesota, a number of years ago, we passed a rule that said, you know, you cannot use it. It's illegal to have lawn fertilizer to contain phosphorus. And I'm not sure whether Wisconsin has that feature or not, but that was a very important move. The lawn chemical people were quite upset. They opposed it in the legislature, but it became the argument in favor of it was the soils, just there's enough phosphorus in the soil for lawns. We don't need to put additional phosphorus into the lawns. There's an exemption for gardens, and there's an exemption for agriculture, where you've got farmers that are dealing with it. But it's certainly impacted folks who have just standard lawns. If I could just jump back in on the comment that you were making with Eric on the metropolitan areas, the problem that metro areas really have a big challenge because there's such an incredible impervious surface area that they have to deal with, and unfortunately, I think a lot of people, at least some people, look at lake problems and say, you know, it's those people that have those cabins on the lakes. Those are the ones that are causing the problem, without realizing watersheds are a big deal. And whether it's a metro watershed or a rural watershed on the edge of a metro area, what happens in those watersheds is a big deal. And I've got a brother, a son-in-law, rather, who's a neat guy, read the book, and then came to me and said, Darby, what's a watershed? I thought, oh, my word, do we have some education.
Yes.
You can be 6-7 miles away and have a major impact on a lake just downstream.
Mm-hmm. And, Eric, what is the story with phosphorus and fertilizers in Wisconsin? Do you know?
Presently it is, as Darby described in Minnesota, it's banned for common use. That you're not – it's kind of a tricky way that they get at it, where you shouldn't be able to find phosphorus fertilizer at your retail outlets. Homeowners are allowed to get the fertilizer if they need to establish a new lawn, and particularly if they can actually show that they've done a test of their soil that shows maybe that it's phosphorus deficient. So, for example, in the Stevens Point in central Wisconsin, we have a lot of sandy soils that if people are trying to get a new lawn going, there might be a good reason to use phosphorus. But what Darby said is absolutely correct, that most people's yards have the amount of phosphorus needed for plants to be healthy and for yards to grow. And so it's kind of ironic that people, and I don't think it's customers really that are driving this to say, hey, I want to be able to buy something that I don't need and put it on my yard that doesn't need it. You know, why would you spend that money? It is really the manufacturers and some of the retailers that look at it and say, this makes things more confusing for us and more confusing for the customers. So can't we just do it the old way? The problem with the old way is that this phosphorus, once it enters into the lakes and rivers, it doesn't really come back out. These water bodies work as sinks that start to accumulate this phosphorus. And we're starting to see problems on lakes where basically all the phosphorus down, even at the depths, the very bottom of the lake, can actually be released out over the course of a summer. and feed into phosphorus in the months of July and August, the times when we really don't need it at all. And that's where we're starting to get what we call harmful algal blooms. And so we think about this as, well, it's just maybe a personal preference thing. But a harmful algal bloom actually has bacteria in it that people get sick and people can die from swimming in this water and from having contact with it. And so, again, we trace this back and say, okay, why do we want people to put fertilizer on a lawn that doesn't need it, where it's going to run off into a lake and create these types of actual public health problems? So thanks to the Wisconsin Lakes Organization and other people that kind of work with lawmakers, we think we have an understanding now about why it makes sense to have this ban in place. And it's going to be one portion of what it takes to, I think, to protect and restore our lakes.
John in Rhinelander. John, are you there?
John in Rhinelander?
Yes.
Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. I'm at work. I was talking to my coworker.
All right, John, you're on.
Great. I grew up on a lake in northern Wisconsin. And watched it change over the years. And we had algae blooms when I was a kid on this lake, and now we don't. And what I've noticed over the years is the amount of boat traffic and the oil that spills from there, two-cycle engines and the exhaust that goes into the water. And the lakes are being overfished and treated unfairly by the people who just want to come up for a couple weeks and roar around on them in their big boats. And I actually think that these lakes need to be shut off from any kind of motorized traffic for 10 years and monitored. I've always felt that way. I'm sorry. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks, John. Thanks for the call. Darby.
Yeah, I think my response would be, and I really empathize with the owner or the caller's question. I'm not sure that the gasoline from the motors, and I may be wrong on this, but I'm not sure that's a major problem. But I think what really probably is, and goes to the heart of what the caller is getting at, is you rile up bottoms. I mean, to the extent to which motorboats, you know, obviously this will be in more shallower reaches of the lake, you get high-powered boats just absolutely churning up water columns, and you're releasing phosphorus like mad. All kinds of other things are being, sediments are being stirred up and so forth. But, Eric, I'm interested if you have a sense of that gasoline role.
The gasoline impact is relatively minor, and what we've seen over time is actually that motorboat engines are getting better and better at being more fuel efficient and also having less of this polluted impact. But at the same time, those engines are getting bigger and bigger, so you can actually find now 250 or 300 horsepower engines. These are the same types of engines that people put into sort of a Ford Mustang to drive, you know, 0 to 60 in a matter of seconds. And people don't realize, I think, what Darby's hitting at, that that's going to have an impact. When you are putting that kind of power on a lake and you are oftentimes in a shallow area, people have to be more conscious of that. The state of Wisconsin does have a program where we work through the DNR to identify what are called sensitive areas around the lake. So these might be places where the aquatic plant community is especially diverse, or in many cases, this is the habitat that fish need in order to breed and reproduce and create the next generation of fish. It's helpful if a local lake association can share with visitors what those sensitive areas are and try and ask people to basically be even more cognizant when they're in that area so that they can sort of take apart, because the caller is right that visitors, if they've never been to the lake and they're not aware of where these areas might be, that creates, you know, they don't really know any better. And we know that there's prop repair places that often cash in because somebody found that rocky shoal that everyone on the lake knows about, but the visitor didn't know about. We can let them know, I guess, where they should be boating fast and where they should be trying to be boating slow. It's going to be hard, I think, to try to conceive of closing lakes off from motorboat use. We do have lakes around the state that are already designated slow, no wake. These are typically smaller lakes. But we're going to, and we have some that actually don't have motors on them because there's really no way to get in and out of them. But I think people are going to want to continue to get out on lakes and recreate the way that they have historically. It's just a matter of doing it responsibly.
Can't we better mark those lakes, though, that have those shallow areas so we have a lot of signs that say slow, no wake? The whole lake doesn't have to be that way, but the shallow areas need to.
It's a good idea, and the trick is kind of implementing that without taking away from the scenic beauty or the natural beauty of the lake itself. And I think potentially we're on the cusp of having some technology where boats increasingly have GPS units in them, or people have GPS-enabled cell phones with them, and you can have lake maps that basically feed that information to someone automatically. So I think we're really close to that. It's becoming more and more common. But to have a lot of buoys out on a lake does detract from what it would look like naturally.
Virginia in Milwaukee. Hi, Virginia.
Good morning to all of you. I've been listening since the very beginning, and this is a subject dear to my heart, and I'm sure to many, many, many people. The world is getting smaller, and we have to be responsible, and I think this is what your guests are talking about here, being personally responsible. Now, I'm a Sunday school a nursery teacher, and we have a lovely little ficus tree in our room, and the children always want to help me water it. So what I do is I teach them when they're there for that hour with me, teach them about the ecology of what the tree needs, light, water, etc. And we need to start very young in the grade schools, even in kindergarten. I'm going to mention and put this fabulous plug in for the Urban Ecology Center, which is over here on the east side of Milwaukee. And I had been there many years ago. I lived right across the street from it, and it wasn't even built then. But it's on the edge of Riverside Park in a fabulous area. And they bring school children in and teach them all about the ecologies. This, I believe, is where we need to start with the children. And, of course, what your guests are saying and the callers have said when they've called in all makes absolutely perfect sense also. Where I come from is starting very, very low in the kindergartens with the children, because they are the future of our world.
Thank you, Virginia. Darby.
Oh, what a wonderful statement. I really applaud everything that that this woman has said. The difference is going to be made ultimately in getting young kids aware of the natural world, aware of our obligations if we're going to keep that natural world anywhere close to natural. I couldn't say it any better than she did. The kids and how we help them explore and learn is the ballgame.
That Urban Ecology Center is a wonderful place. Would that we had centers like that, and maybe there are many of them in the state of Wisconsin. Are there ecology centers? Do we need more of them, Eric?
I'd say they are out there. I think the biggest challenge really is getting children motivated and getting them out into those resources themselves. So the places are there. We have hundreds of youth camps in Wisconsin. We have nature centers really all over the state. It's always a challenge just getting people out there to visit them. One of the things that we actually take on at the convention coming up, we have workshops that are sort of longer sessions kicking off the event. And one of them is called Educating for Stewardship. And it's basically a 3-hour morning workshop where we're going to have someone come in from a nonprofit group in Northwest Wisconsin that does exactly that, tries to get people out onto the resource. We also have a partner from one of our county land and water conservation offices coming in to talk about what St. Croix County has done in western Wisconsin. And then one of my colleagues at Stevens Point, Lynn Markham, has actually written a children's book about getting outside into nature and understanding sort of what a healthy ecology looks like and how important all those different pieces are. So Lynn Markham from the Center for Land Use Education will be in this workshop as well. It's just one small sliver of all the different things we try to accomplish every year at the convention in Green Bay.
Thanks, Virginia, so much for your call. Let's go next to Hope in Lake Mills. Hi, Hope.
Good morning. I wanted to join the conversation and mention the Wisconsin Lake Leadership Group that I'm a member of. And I wanted to talk about the project that this group has taken on. And you know about this, Eric. We are proposing a restoration for the shoreline at the governor's mansion or the executive residence here in Madison, Wisconsin. group of us here have been working on it for the last probably year and a half. We now have permission to do the restoration, and this project will be rolled out at the convention this year. We'll be looking for donations of time, energy, money, and plant material to do this restoration. And this will be a banner project for the people of Madison and people in the state of Wisconsin to see that their executive residence mansion, which is right on Lake Mendota, will be treated exactly as it should be and have a full restoration done on it. I'm really excited about the project.
Oh, my. I'm sure you're quite familiar with it, Eric.
I am, and a couple of things. The Lake Leaders Institute is one of the things that the partnership does, where we engage with citizens and other people around the state who want to step up their advocacy work with lakes. And here we have a case where the alumni from one of the Lake Leaders groups identified the governor's residence as a big project they wanted to take on. And it really hits on what I said earlier, where public properties in the state of Wisconsin are starting to look at how they're dealing with lake resources. And so this is really just one example of what I mentioned with state parks and other properties where, you know, it's hard to look at that and say, hey, if we want everyone else around the shore of Lake Mendota to have a healthy waterfront property, why would the governor's residence be excluded from that? And instead, I think the governor and his wife have agreed that, you know, it does make sense for them to be participating in the protection and renewal of the lakes right there in Madison.
More phone calls momentarily. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. You can also send an email if you would like, and that's talk@WPR.org. We have two guests with us, Darby Nelson, author, scientist, teacher, former lawmaker from Minnesota. He is the author of a highly acclaimed book, Aldo Leopold's Sand County Almanac is the book that it's being compared to. He traveled to many lakes and he understands lakes pretty fully. He's one of the keynote speakers at the upcoming 2012 Wisconsin Lakes Partnership Convention. It is April 10 through April 12 in Green Bay. Eric Olson, director of the UW Extension Lakes Program based in Stevens Point. He works with the DNR and Wisconsin Lakes to educate the public about effective lake protection. More phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to an email that's come in from Gary in Iron River. I've heard the comment about leaves and phosphorus. In northern Wisconsin, we have many lakes ringed with oak trees, and the leaves have always gone into the lakes. We don't really have an algae problem, but the decomposing leaves create a muck layer, even though we are in sandy gravel glacial till. After a weekend of heavy boating, pontoons with their props churning deep in the water, the lakes are noticeably cloudier, and then it settles out during the week. I see enzymes advertised to put into the lake to eat the muck. Is this a good idea? Darby?
Well, I'm not sure about enzymes being a good idea. If you get organic matter, and all lakes are going to get organic matter naturally, regardless of what we do, and it's a pretty natural event. But what's going to happen, I mean, I don't know that there are already aquatic creatures like bacteria and aquatic fungi that are very, very capable of decomposing. In fact, they are the decomposer, perform the decomposer role in an aquatic system. So whether enzymes... I presume maybe there are some enzymes that do speed that up, but Mother Nature has that in play already to a pretty effective degree. Again, I'm not familiar with the extent to which those enzymes would really make a difference.
Eric?
And I guess I would caution anybody before putting a chemical into a lake. We have a really comprehensive process that the Wisconsin DNR goes through to certify which chemicals can be used in lakes, and also to certify who can put them in. So it's not really for the amateur to start monkeying with the chemistry in their lake. And I also suspect that a product like this might be a bit of a sort of snake oil, because a lake, in terms of the amount of water that you're dealing with, is so large. And as Darby mentioned, there's already enzymes and bacteria in the lake that are going to work on decomposing things. To try to suggest that somehow a homeowner can impact that with a commercially purchased product, it just seems a little bit out of proportion. And I would point out also, Darby's right. Trees and their leaves are always contributing to lakes. What he was pointing out is that the problem is that in an urban environment, people sometimes get that right into the storm sewer system, and now you've basically made the shoreline of the lake giant because it encompasses, for example, all of the Twin Cities area if everyone was letting their leaves go right into those storm sewers. So it's really a matter of proportionality.
Let's go to Carolyn in Arborvita. Hi, Carolyn.
Good morning. We were on Geneva Lake in southern Wisconsin for 43 years, and our hardworking, very hardworking watershed agency performed a 5-year study that showed that air pollution to be a serious problem. Is that still considered to be a lake problem?
Go ahead, Darby.
Okay, I was just going to say that, yeah, surprisingly enough, but the data has been gathered about the impact of atmospheric deposition a number of years ago, and it turns out that, yeah, we're getting phosphorus out of the atmosphere as well as we're getting mercury out of the atmosphere and so forth. The degree to which it's a problem varies certainly within what sorts of other activities are going on in the surrounding area in terms of that are producing air issues, but yeah, I mean the caller is right. In fact, phosphorus is one of the elements that does enter lakes by atmospheric deposition.
And I would point out it is again about proportionality. In the case of Geneva and some other lakes that have what we call a really small watershed. So if you think of the area where the runoff is coming into Lake Geneva, it's actually geographically pretty small relative to the size of that lake. And so in part that explains why Lake Geneva has the high water quality that it does, but it also means that every minor contribution into that lake seems proportionally large because, for example, all the rainfall and snowmelt that comes into that lake, it's delivering phosphorus on a regular basis. In a lake like Mendota, or in the case of most of our northern lakes that have larger watersheds, that atmospheric deposition is not a big deal. But if you have a very small watershed, suddenly it looks like a lot. The challenge is that there isn't much you can do about controlling that. And so instead, you still do have to focus on the things that are within your control, looking at, well, what even though it's a small watershed, are there some points where runoff is sort of eroding the shoreline or creating other problems? But yeah, certainly it is in the atmosphere.
Thanks, Carolyn. Dick in Waukesha. Hi.
Yes. In Waukesha, where I live, we have a rule that says you can't blow grass into the street when you're mowing the lawn. But I don't know how often it's enforced, but when I mow my lawn, I have a mulching lawnmower, I make the pass next to the curb with the blower flowing in toward the sidewalk, and I get very little grass that goes into the gutter, and that I clean up. How much would we save if we made that mandatory that you go? Sure, in the fall it's tough with the leaves, but the rest of the year, how much would we reduce the problem by making people sweep up the gutter?
Well, I think, Dick, you're doing the right thing and paying attention to this. It may seem like a small thing when just one property owner is doing it, but then you have to multiply that out across thousands and thousands of property owners, or in the case of Southeast Milwaukee, really millions of properties. And every little bit can actually make a difference. It's that cumulative impact. One thing that cities do that they're increasingly required to do is actually send out the street sweepers to get some of that sediment as well as plant material out of the street, and then they have a place where they can actually deposit it so that it doesn't go right into the lake system. As far as could anybody really police this and verify how people are treating their grass clippings, I mean, it's kind of ironic. Again, here grass clippings can be a really rich material to use to create mulch and to create your own fertilizer for your gardens or to share with people for their gardens. But a lot of people put them in bags and send them off somewhere else. So why not keep things on your property rather than sending them somewhere else?
We are almost out of time. Do you have a website address for the convention that's coming up?
We do, but it's unfortunately long and complex. And so the easiest way for people to find it is just to Google search or use their search engine, look for the 2012 Wisconsin Lakes Partnership Convention, or even just look up UW Extension Lakes, and we'll pop up. You'll find information online for how to register. You can still register if you want to check this out. You can register for just one day. It's Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Or you can register for all three. We'd be more than happy to have new people coming out and checking out the convention. It really is one of the biggest gatherings of people who care about lakes across the country. So Wisconsin has a great legacy of 34 annual lakes conventions.
Great. And it sounds like it's a very important convention as well. Thank you both so much for being with us. A lot of interest in this topic. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Darby Nelson, author, scientist, former legislator in Minnesota, teacher. He taught for a number of years. His book is For Love of Lakes, and he will be one of the keynote speakers at this convention. Eric Olson, director of the UW Extension Lakes Program based in Stevens Point. Rhonda also said she'll post this on her Facebook page, links to the conference. So that's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can register or find out more about the issues they will be discussing. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll be with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.